Coming up, actor Bruce Davison joins Ileana in just a minute.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
And now, it's the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast, starring Ileana Douglas. Eavesdrop with Ileana as she interviews Hollywood's most prominent players about filmmaking, acting, and what really happens on the set of your favorite flicks and TV shows.
Hello, everyone. Hi. I am Ileana Douglas. Welcome to the I Blame Dennis Hopper podcast. I am here with my lovely co-host, Tamara Bird.
Hi, everybody.
Here in the studio in lovely downtown Burbank.
Yes.
And it's so interesting. You were mentioning this article that you saw about...
Yes.
About the lack of that there's been less movies shot in
Los Angeles. On location feature film production in greater Los Angeles fell 18.5% in the second quarter of this year, according to Film LA, the permitting agency, and that's from Variety.
Yes.
So, let's talk about that.
I can speak about this quite a bit. You know, I'm currently setting up a film, and the big issue is everybody always wants to shoot in Canada or Atlanta. Usually there's some hot spot, and mainly it has to do with, you know, tax breaks.
Right.
Is that you get a lot of money back. And what's interesting is just currently in my film, there's two things that I'm fighting for. Is that if you have a relationship, so there's many things in my script takes place in Los Angeles,
right.
And so I have a lot of connections. I don't have any connections in Toronto, Canada.
Yeah, exactly.
And so my storyboards reflect locations that I have been to. I'd like to shoot some of it in my house. You know, there's a certain vision that the filmmaker has, a certain flavor. And it was interesting, right? When we were talking at the top of the show last night, I was watching The Graduate. And you think, you know, the whole movie is these incredible scenes of, you know, San Francisco and Pasadena and Beverly Hills and just the way the light looks. And imagine if they said, you know, we want to shoot this in Atlanta, or a movie that you know, lots of movies that shoot in New York, that they want the feel of New York, you know, they go to Atlanta. And so you're really cut off as a filmmaker, I think, for what you can show, because you can't, you know, you can't widen out the camera because you're going to, you know,
give away the secret.
Yeah, you're going to reveal something. And so I always argue, you know, is it in the end 50-50 in terms of, you know, how much is the tax break worth, and how much do you get breaks here from people that want to do, you know, you a favor and will cut their location fee, et cetera,
right.
et cetera. But I guess, but the biggest issue for me is just the personal, you know, kind of a flavor. And then the other thing is just pride in your city.
Yes.
I mean, come on, LA, like, let's not, you know, let's let movies be shot here. We're the Hollywood USA.
Yeah.
It's my favorite thing to see at the end of a movie from an old time.
Well,
movie.
I mean, La La Land was such an iconic film and a great example, because you had so many things that just couldn't be anywhere else, you know?
I'm one of the people, I love LA. I had initially, like everyone else, I'd lived in New York for many years and had kind of a love-hate relationship with it when I first came out here. But through the years, I've just developed a real love for the little, you know, nooks and crannies of Los Angeles. And there's some quite, you know, beautiful things amongst the mini malls and things like that.
Yeah.
But I guess it's always the light. You know, that's the thing you're always looking for, is a certain type of light anywhere you shoot. You know, Paris has a certain light. Mm-hmm. New York has a certain light. Los Angeles has a certain light. Los Angeles at night, I mean, again, going back to a graduate, because I just saw it again last night with commentary, which is my favorite way to see movies lately. But, you know, LA at night, it just really does have a kind of interesting, magical, you know, quality.
Yeah.
So, I hope that changes. Hopefully, you know, as I say, I'm fighting very hard to make my movie here.
Well, and there have been a lot of, you know, attempts to bring production back. I mean, there was the one of the people that they interviewed for this article said that there was actually a spike in production in 2016. So the decline in 2017 is actually compared to a year when there was a lot of production coming here. And he says there's nothing to panic about. The feature film category rose 12% in 2016, including a 22% jump in the fourth quarter, which might have, like, La La Land might have been part of that. Anyway, you know, since the state launched its film and television tax credit program in 2009, there's really been an effort to bring production back to Los Angeles. And, yes. You know, there's a lot of reasons to. Yes, John?
I have a question,
Ileana.
Sure.
Yeah, go for it.
So how much does it weigh into your decision about to do a project if it's local,
yes,
or if you have to go somewhere? I mean, obviously it has some effect. But
I just think for me as a director and as a writer, when you visualize something and when you storyboard something and when you imagine something and when you feel really passionate about it, it's tied to, you know, your vision. And if your vision is a certain type of light that's in Los Angeles, or, you know, the way that there's spaces in Los Angeles that I want to write into the script that you only see in Los Angeles,
yeah, right,
that you would have a very hard time finding. And again, I'm going to go back to The Graduate.
Sure.
You would have you could not find that kind of Beverly Hills,
right,
bright light and swimming pools. There's just something iconic about it in Los Angeles.
What about as an actor, where you say, well, they're going to shoot, I'm in town, or, you know,
yeah,
does that...
I mean, I always love to be on location for,
yeah,
the type of movie you did. Ironically, when we did Grace of My Heart and we did a reshoot, it was New York. We did a scene that was... see if I can get this right. The reshoot that we did in New York was meant to be Los Angeles.
Oh my gosh.
It was completely crazy. So we did a Malibu scene, and then we did like a reshoot, and we were in the middle of Central Park.
Oh my
and
our, gosh.
We were shooting this scene in Central Park, me and Patsy Kensit, and they were also shooting First Wives Club. Like in of course they had, you know, lights and trailers, and we had like a pop-up tent, and it was hysterical. I remember Scott Rudin accidentally walked onto our set.
Oh my
gosh.
And
he was like furious, like, where is everyone? We were like, you're in the wrong movie. You're the big movies down the way. But
look for the trailers.
Anyway, and then before we bring Bruce in, I just want to thank everyone again for listening. We've had such terrific guests, and we really appreciate the comments. And
yeah, I want to do some shout-outs to a couple of specific people who
Please
have
do.
Made comments to us. Forgive me if I don't pronounce names right, but Edward Nahon Paul Broussard, and
yes,
Buddy Davis all have written really nice comments on our Facebook page.
Yes.
So look for
Twitter.
That on Facebook. And our website is ilianaspodcast.com, where you can find everything. You know, you can find our Instagram, you can find our Facebook page, and
yes,
everything else there.
Also, this, I just wanted to read this one out to Eric Rubin, the Eric Rubin on Twitter. There's money to be made in Ileana Rama's audition experiences and advice on podcast.
Really. Oh yeah.
Yeah, I like
Absolutely.
That. We like that. I don't want any money. I do it merely as an artist to serve man, as to quote Twilight episode. Well, let's get
let's
to
bring
great
in Bruce
Davison in here. Of course he's known for Longtime Companion. He was a Golden Globe winner, Academy Award an Academy Award nominee. There's my camera. And also in X-Men. Of course, he started out with Willard. We're going to get to Last Summer. We were both on You Were Memorable on Seinfeld. There's so many things we're gonna get to here. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome Bruce Davison.
Hello.
Oh, my God, I forgot to mention Grace of My Heart. That's crazy. And we
That's
were in
good.
Grace of My Heart. Look at you. It's like your son. It's like looking at your son.
Oh, God. I ate a rat turd doing that movie by accident.
One oh, time. No!
Yeah. I used to have chocolate in my pocket, and there's one...
For them?
Huh?
For the rats?
No, for me.
Oh!
Well, like M&Ms, you know,
oh,
sort of something to do. And
oh,
then
I
one
sure.
then one day I had to do one with the one in my pocket, and then, you know, I was just... Ooh.
Oh.
That's not,
yeah,
okay,
that does not taste
it's
right.
You're lucky you're alive. My God, that's scary. Okay, we've so much to get to, because you're like me, love movies, and you've worked with so many great. We've got a lot of interesting crossovers, too.
Yes, we certainly do.
So hopefully we're going to get to all of these. But we start with my favorite question. What was the first movie you saw, and who took you to see it?
Oh.
If you can remember.
Yes, I certainly can. My father, who my mother and my father separated when I was three. And he would get me on Saturdays at 9 till Sunday at night. And he would always take me, as I remember, to the first movie that I saw, because I keep wanting to go back, which was King Solomon's Mines with Deborah Carr in her red hair and Stuart Granger in his hat. And I based my life on that for as long as I can remember. I used to go in school. I would go up to girls that were intimidating me, and I would say, "Don't sit there, ants." They do what you do. They just sort of laugh at me like I'm an idiot.
I love things like that. Yes. No, I used to. Well, you do. I remember when I was really little watching Gone with the Wind, you know, yes. And then I'd walk, I'd be, my mother, "What is the matter with you?" And I'd be like, "It's working."
Totally. Always walking into the sunset, saying, someday, yes.
Oh, I love things like that. Yeah. So you said your parents were divorced when you were three. That's yeah. I mean, did that affect you? And
I guess. I'm sure it seemed natural at the time. But, yeah, it did. It did affect me, I'm sure. I always was a great mimic through that, and I used to listen to my records. I had a lot of records.
Me too.
You know, I'm sure you did. There's only 50 of us. We keep changing hats.
Well, again, what's funny? We were poor, so like we didn't have modern records. It would just be a record. Like other kids had records, but I'd be listening to Alice in Wonderland or Berlives, things like that.
Well, that's what I would listen to, whatever my aunts or uncles would give me, which was usually Claude Rains reading Bible stories. So I would copy them. So I would copy them and think this is what I should do. And if I ever had to go to bed and there were adults over and my mother would say, "Go to bed. Go to bed." I would go to the top of the stairs and I'd say, "This is the story of David and Goliath, the young shepherd boy who went down to the river and chose 5 smooth stones and put them in his sling and walked off to meet the giant." And everybody would laugh and fall down, and I'd get to stay up for hours doing that, which would then segue into Joseph in his coat of many colors.
Oh my God, I love that. Well, he was great. I love him in so many movies. Voyager. He's like my fantasy of my psychiatrist.
Oh, wouldn't that be nice if they were all like
him? You just need a nice rest. The way at Gables or whatever it's called.
Yes.
With Claude Rains as your teacher.
Learn how to smoke.
Yes. He was apparently married, 18 times or something.
Well, they had to do that back then, I think. And then the 60s came along, and we just got to be with everybody for 3-year increments, usually, I think.
So I was reading, and I don't know if this... Did you sort of fall into acting, or did you nurse?
Well, I like I say, I always was a mimic. I always, Flash Gordon would always play Flash Gordon, and my best friend from the Catholic school would be Professor Zarkov, and we were always auditioning Dale Arden, to give her the dust of forgetfulness so she wouldn't tell her mother, that kind of thing. So I always was acting, but I never knew that it was a real kind of thing that you could actually do.
Did you have confidence? Like, I nursed that dream, but I just didn't think.
No.
Again.
Never had confidence with it. I was playing.
Yeah.
As long as I was playing and nobody was, I wasn't auditioning, then I was fine. The minute I had to start auditioning, it all went in the toilet.
Were there actors? I mean, you mentioned Claude Rains. For me growing up, it sounds like a goofy transition, but I loved the Marx Brothers, and then I discovered Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh.
To me, he was sort of like me.
Yes,
Ed
he is
Groucho.
Sort of. He is sort of like you. I had to kiss him every night in the Normal Heart. And I said, "Okay, tonight you be Elizabeth McGovern, I'll be Lonnie Anderson." And he'd say, "No, I'm just thinking of you." And I went, "Holy shit.
Oh, hello, Richard." Yeah.
But I should have thought of you. Of course. You are Richard Dreyfuss.
Oh, my God. Okay, we got to get to that. Kissing Richard Dreyfuss. I was trying to think if I ever. I played his wife, but I don't think we kissed in it.
You didn't?
No. But we kissed. But
I had
we're
to
gonna
get him to
that.
Shave. Right. Sorry.
That is. Yeah, that was, and I mean, I'm skipping around, but that's like back in the day, there was probably more sort of heebie-jeebies to doing.
Yeah. Well, this was
male
the this is 1987.
Yes.
So this was the Normal Heart, right at the right in the middle of that Holocaust. Of,
It's amazing, and now it's like you think we're, you know, where we've come.
Yeah.
To
since
now.
From then, it's quite a history, quite a long history of growth. We've seen a lot. I mean, it's amazing. I look back and I am a Neanderthal and my son is a Cro-Magnon. You know, we'd be driving down the streets when he was 14 or something. And I'd say, wow, look at the rack on that girl. And he'd say, do you know anything about her?
Oh, really?
And I think, oh, Jesus. All right. Well, I guess, you know, somebody has evolved. Somebody hasn't.
That's funny. The so I want to start with your first movie, which I love, your film debut last summer with the great director, Frank Perry, who did Diary of a Mad Housewife, which I love. Mm-hmm. Later on, people know him from the film Mommy Dearest. This was a script. Was this written by his wife?
Yes.
So they were early on a couple working together. Also they did Dave and Lisa.
Yes. Eleanor, in fact, she wrote a book when they divorced years later called Blue Pages, which unfortunately we're all in because it all was happening and blowing apart during, during about
fantastic.
That time. Yeah.
But so tell me, how did you get in the film? This is an incredible film.
Yeah, it's a kind of, I was at NYU. Mm-hmm. I was sort of at the end of my rope. I was living in the Lower East Side in a slum apartment, just getting robbed every other week and going to NYU to the School of the Arts. And I managed through a commercial agent that had been sending me up for stuff to go in as an audition. And I had just come from an audition on Broadway for something. And I remember sitting in the lobby with a guy, and I had a seersucker suit on. It was 100 degrees and, you know, with a washcloth across your face kind of humidity in New York. And this guy was sitting across from me, and he was like 60s, in his 60s, maybe 70. He looked like me. He had the same seersucker suit on. And he looked over and he said, Broadway, huh? And I said, yeah. He says, you ever been on Broadway? I said, no, not yet. He said, well, me neither. I've been trying for 57 years. And I thought, I'm going to die. And I remember walking down the subway thinking, my life is over. That's the end. And I walked into Frank Perry's office for this audition. And I did. And I got the part.
Wow.
Didn't get it right away. Had to audition like 3 or 4 times. Mm-hmm. And stuff, but he just swept me into the world. Mm-hmm. He swept me into the world of my fantasies and my dreams, and he was there. And he was always bigger than life. Frank was sort of the drugstore philosopher. Mes enfants, come with me, my children. You know, he was great. And he just swept me into that world. He's sort of like Sir Guy de Guy in Pinocchio, I guess, you know.
And so did you rehearse? I mean,
so
just a little background on the movie. It starts Barbara Hershey, yourself, and Richard Thomas, and...
Catherine Burns.
Catherine Burns.
Who was nominated for the film for Best Supporting Actor for the year, and did like 2 other films and stopped working.
And it's really kind of, it's an interesting psychological movie. It sort of has echoes, a little bit of sort of, I don't know, it reminds me a little bit of Jules and Jim, but it has that, you know, sort of threesome psychological quality. And then it gets dark, of course.
Yeah. Then it becomes The Virgin Spring.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly. That's what it sort of reminded me of. But did you? So obviously you have great chemistry in the film. Mm-hmm. Was any of it improv?
Yeah, a lot of it was improv and encouraged by Frank to do that, and a wonderful cast. I mean, and we all really did love each other. We got along very well. It was a great break for every one of us. You know, it was our first film. We were just standing on the precipice, the doorway, the threshold of, you know,
getting in there and doing something worthwhile.
I think that that's what's so appealing about the film, and it doesn't look amateurish in the way that it looks or is shot. It doesn't feel improvisational. It feels very polished.
Yes. Yes. Well, we did rehearse a bit some of the larger scenes. We rehearsed up in Frank's apartment with Frank and Eleanor's apartment up in off of Central Park West.
And what was he trying to say with the movie?
I remember I used to be an usher at this theater, Lawrence Park Theater, and it just had the headlines on it. Last summer, kids today. So I don't know. It was sort of like...
like Antonioni for youngsters? Right,
exactly. It was kind of that. It was sort of like, you know, the dark side of freedom.
Well, when you think of Frank Perry's, I mean, his early work, you know, which is...
David and Lisa.
David and Lisa, Last Summer, Diary of a Mad Housewife, The Swimmer.
And that's what he said. He said, you're the children of the swimmer.
Interesting.
And
I got chills. That is really interesting.
Yeah, and I got to work with Bert years later, and I'd run up to him, and I'd say, I'll name it the Lucinda River, after my wife. And he'd say, son, leave it to Gorshin. He does a much better one than you.
I know. I want to get to that. So, and then also the another just little highlight of the movie is that it's a soundtrack film. Mm-hmm. So it's similar to the kind of in the vein of Easy Rider, in that in the middle of the movie you're like, hey, let's put on a song, and it's the band.
It's the band before they had any real success.
Yeah, it's not like Hollywood movie where it's like, wah, nah, right. nah, nah. It's actually really good.
Yeah, it was their music. And Robbie Robertson taught me my first three chords on the guitar.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. So what happened? How soon from that did you get Willard? Was it
The next thing that came along was a film, was The Strawberry Statement, and that was a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
I was, during the course of that summer, I was still at NYU, so I was a student while I did the movie, and then I had to come back and fight my way through the politics of, student life as a senior in a school that was just beginning to form and try to figure out the rules. And I was kind of a football that was kicked around in the middle of that. And then I had one more year. And during the course of that time, I ended up in summer stock doing a play with Ionesco. Actually, that's a story I should tell you.
Sure.
Ionesco was there up at Heaton Hall in Stockbridge. And it was a play that that he wanted to have done on Broadway. And he was there for the first time, and I had a small kind of part in it. But I had had a professor at Penn State that wrote a book called The Theater of Protest and Paradox by George Wellworth. And it was about the French guys that came up, Genet, and Ionesco was in there in the middle of it. And I knew all this stuff about him from that, his personal stuff. And when I was there, they had he didn't speak a word of English. And they brought a guy up, and the guy was a translator from the New York Times, and they were doing interviews, and it was a party for him, and it was Sunday, and I was kind of drunk, and I got kind of full of myself, and I started talking to the translator like we're talking now, and I said, is it true that you did the Bald Soprano for your draft board, and that's how you got out of the draft? And then I said, is it true that you were a Romanian spy during World War II and that you actually was a spy for the Allies? This boy knows more about me than I know about myself. And this went on for the time, and then they left. We did the play. He sat there for 2 weeks, and I would drive him down to rehearsal every time, and he would come up with me for 2 weeks without saying a word because we couldn't speak. And finally his daughter showed up 2 weeks later who spoke English, and I drove him up the hill and dropped him off, and he looked at me and he said, it's a long walk up that hill. That's my UNESCO story.
That sounds like from one of his plays.
Exactly.
It made me think while you were talking that it's such a shame that people who go into acting these days don't go to acting school, because sometimes it's not so much about going to learn how to act. It's getting a frame of reference.
Exactly.
To learn about Tennessee Williams, William Inge, mm-hmm. Ionescu, Edward Albee, just to have a language.
So many people don't know now. You know, you'll talk to kids, and who's Tennessee Williams? Who is that? Is he a basketball player or something?
Well, and then to understand Ionescu, even if you don't relate to it, the kind of the theater of the absurd.
Right.
And then how that affected Zero Mostel, or, you know, it's the history of our business. And as I mm-hmm. say, like, it's just to see kind of what you like mm-hmm. and what you don't like.
Yeah. Or what is the history of what you're doing?
Right.
How did it evolve?
Right. Because it didn't just happen.
You know, just didn't start with Aeschylus, you know.
Well, and where he is interesting is that maybe if you have everything that's classical, then he's breaking down everything
right.
that's classical.
Right, yes, he's going through the whole thing, and it had a very darkness to him that was the absurdity.
And would you say something like, Harold Pinter is in the same category?
Well,
in a
I would
different
say
way,
and yes.
that breaking down.
It's interesting. You watch the progression of it. You had Genet and Ionescu and Waiting for Godot, Beckett, and all mm-hmm. of that, and you see the way that broke down into kind of an absurdity, breaking down the laws and the rules of what theater is supposed to be and was. And
right.
then you see, you know, Osborne and Pinter and all mm-hmm. coming in, destroying the British drawing room comedy, which, mm-hmm. you know, then buried Coward for years.
Right. And then it sort of starts to get built back
up.
Yeah. In the 60s.
Exactly.
And then especially like in the play that you were in, The Streamers.
Yes.
And The Normal Heart.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, I mean, I find things like that fascinating.
Yeah.
Just to get, as you said it,
It's
the
fashion.
Sense.
It becomes fashion. Mm-hmm. What leads from one success to the next, and you as well, know as well as I do in the mm-hmm. business, you can watch the progressions of fashion.
Mm-hmm.
You can see what's successful. And it's a business, so you see everybody trying to copy it. And,
mm-hmm.
And it's, who was it that said, there are the inventors, the imitators, and the idiots.
Mm-hmm.
The progression of the way,
yeah.
the way a movement goes.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens in all business and in any new idea,
mm-hmm.
with any new thing. You have somebody that's the inventor of something new, and then it's imitated and imitated and imitated, and then the idiots come along and destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're back to starting a new system.
So then when you're doing, and you, did you shoot The Strawberry Statement in Los Angeles?
Yes.
Was it on a college
campus? It was at a fake college that does not exist in San Francisco.
Oh, I see.
And in Sacramento.
This is interesting because, again, you know, we keep referencing The Graduate.
Yeah.
But
mm-hmm.
In the commentary, Mike Nichols was saying that when he was making The Graduate, even
yes.
though it's considered this great success, mm-hmm. a lot of people hated The Graduate because it was opposite of the kind of films that actually people were making
at that time,
like The Strawberry Statement. Or
yeah, but then somebody laughs and somebody is moved and somebody is moved to tears over it, and suddenly it's new and innovative.
Yeah.
So let's copy that. From
yeah.
now on. It's amazing. And that was Dustin's career, how it began.
So when you were making the movie, were you caught up in the kind of the war movement?
I was coming out of NYU, and mm-hmm. we were sort of in the middle of it at the time. I got hit over the head with a pipe at a demonstration in Washington Square in the middle of it all in the 66, 67. I was sort of right in the middle of that.
Did you think it was the end of the world? I mean, did it feel like it was the end of the world? Did it really feel like, I mean, when you look, again, we're so distanced. It's like the 60s.
To that period of time.
Yeah.
At the time, it did. It felt
I mean,
like.
I was a kid watching it.
It felt like the soul of America was dying.
Yeah.
And we were standing by and watching, and if there was nothing you could do to change that, it was the end of the world.
Yeah.
But now we maybe feel that way again. I mean, it's another cycle, and how things have passed through that again.
I think maybe the difference is, you know, being a child and having my parents be, you know,
hippies.
I thought my parents were going to die, like, you know, because I was very little. You know, you'd think that they were going to go, they'd be killed or something, because I was watching things like that on television.
Yeah.
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 And going to these protest.
And you were much younger. Yeah. So it's got to be that effect, you know.
Oh, it really did. It really did feel like kind of life or death because I didn't know any other, you know, kind of world. So then the Strawberry Statement, which is another movie I really recommend with Kim Darby. Mm-hmm. Had she done True Grit?
True Grit. She'd just come off of True Grit. Yeah.
And so it's so interesting balancing. Are you trying to balance studio movies with these kind of indies, or was it there's no?
No,
such
I'm.
Thing?
I've done what I've always done. I've gone where I'm kicked, and you know whatever comes along that's going to pay the rent and is going to be hopefully, if you have the opportunity and are successful enough to choose what you do,
right?
To do a good story, it's always the good story and the good character that I'm looking for. Yeah. I don't always get that choice.
Yeah. And so then this leads you into, you're doing Willard.
Okay.
That's where I was, was there any hesitancy?
To do that? Oh, it's my agent called me up, said, go over to, where they do Star Trek over there. They want to meet you for this film. It's a starring role. Go ahead. And so I go over there. And I start talking to Danny Mann, the director, and
want to stop you. I hate to interrupt, but Daniel Mann, no slouch, did Come Back, Little Sheba.
I'll Cry Tomorrow. He got all these Academy Awards. For
very famous director coming out of the 50s.
Right.
So, sorry, continue.
So I did a scene for them. I auditioned, as I've always done. Mm-hmm. I love auditioning. Gives me a chance to play and work and see if everybody's on the same page on something. Mm-hmm. Whether I was young. I instinctively liked it when I was young. I like it now.
That's amazing.
I did that, and they all looked at each other, and they say, okay, you got some time? I said, yeah. He says, well, I want you to come out to Burbank with us and meet your co-star. So we drive out to this little house in Burbank, and woman lifts up a garage door, and we walk in there, and there's like 300 rats in there, and she takes this big one the size of a bunny and puts it on my shoulder, and it starts snooping my ear, and I kind of smile, and I tickle it under its chin.
Oh my God.
Like that, and I go, and he says, okay, kid, you got the job.
And so. You had no, because I have a fear of
I had hamster. I had a hamster when I was a kid. I had a
not a rat. The hamsters don't have long.
No, they don't have the tail. But
they're not the size of a bunny. Either.
Some of us don't have hair.
Yeah,
some of us do. Yeah,
I had a hard time even looking at the trailer.
Yeah, they're not like the rats in New York, where they're quick and they'll steal your pizza and stuff. These were fat, slow Burbank rats in air conditioning. That just sort of sat in a room and just sat up for the peanut butter.
Yeah.
They didn't really. And I mean, they're a hell to act with. I mean, you got to tickle their bellies to get them to move their heads, and then they got to put in the afterwards. So
but
that's,
you didn't have a you didn't have a thought. I mean, here and you were working with Ernest Borgnine.
Well, Ernie hadn't been on board yet. Ernie came after I got the job.
Okay.
And then he came along.
And so you're on set. It's you, rats, and Ernest Borgnine. And you weren't thinking like I always. I did a very low budget movie with Ryan O'Neill.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I was mortified. I was like, oh my God, one day you're doing Barry Lyndon and the next minute you're changing in a tent, hi, Mr. O'Neill. Pleasure to meet you. But you didn't have, did you have any of that vibe at all? Like, I'm with Ernest Borgnine. So star of Marty.
Marty, he was great. And he gave me the best advice I ever had, too. He said, never go to bed angry at your wife. If you got to stay up for days, stay up for days and argue for 24, 48 hours till you fall asleep. But never go to bed angry at your wife.
Interesting. Well, having he was married to Ethel Merman for 6 days.
He didn't talk about her. I said, what about her? Yeah, well, that's where I learned. I was angry at her from the moment I met her.
I consider that one of the great showbiz mysteries.
She wrote a book about it. She says, all I have to say about Ernest Borgnine, and it's a blank page. And then you turn the page.
It's really classy.
But he was great. We did shoot a scene in which he got a little frustrated, but he had one run up his pant leg one day, and that was pretty. They didn't like that. He thought, okay, I'm about done with this goddamn movie. But we had a scene in which, very shortly in the course of that scene,
yes,
I have this iron pole, this iron bar that I come with, and I'm sort of poking at the thing and stuff with, and then I say, tear him up, and I accidentally hit him in the foot with my thing. You can see this in the movie, too.
Yeah.
He pulled it out of my hand and swung for my head. I ducked, and it went right through the set, and it's... which is great, and it's in the movie. It's really, it was really quick, but it's a great moment. I'm glad I ducked.
Oh my goodness!
We're all glad you ducked.
It's so funny with the movie because it was now it's sort of considered a cult classic. You said it just came out,
which is interesting because the I tried to remake it with John Landis years afterwards, but. We couldn't get a copy of the original because they had all been lost in a big proxy war with Bing Crosby Productions and Paramount and Cox Entertainment. It disappeared. The film was written in snow. Nobody could find a good copy of it. Everywhere I went, people would ask me about it.
Yeah.
Finally, they found one, I think, in New Zealand, and they've just released it on Blu-ray this year. So now it's finally back out there, and it's great.
And where are those rats? I'd like to know. What happened?
Well, Ben ended up with a bunny over in Burbank, and I think he died by a swimming pool.
That's the sad story in all of this. Yeah. Okay, let's get to Olzana's Raid.
Yes.
With Robert Aldridge. Robert Aldridge just depicted in the movie Feud.
Yeah.
So he's having a little bit of a comeback. And Burt Lancaster. And you have an amazing story. I want to hear your amazing story of working with Burt Lancaster. And you guys, it's one of your first shots where you're in a two-shot,
both on
horses.
Yeah, I tell my Burt Lancaster story a lot because it had great influence on me. Of course, I grew up with the Crimson Pirate, and his sidekick in the Crimson Pirate, the mute guy, is Nick.
Yeah,
and Nick was his catcher.
Right,
that they came out of Hell's Kitchen together. Mm-hmm. And Nick couldn't say any lines because he talked like this and everything he says was like this. But he was in Olzana's Raid as well. I have a picture of the with the both of them. And they were, you know.
I can't even imagine working with these. I mean, I'm so enamored of Burt Lancaster.
So was I. I mean, I just was. And I don't know what possessed me, but I was co-starring with him. Now, if you can imagine a 23-year-old full of himself kid co-starring with Burt Lancaster, and we're out on our first shot, and we're riding along, and it's a two shot behind the mountains, and the sun we're losing, we got a minute to shoot the scene, and he's saying I say, well, let's go after him. He says, we can't go after them, you know Patchy will ride 50 miles till his horse drops dead on him, and he'll cut off a piece, eat it, steal another. Ain't no way you're going to beat that, Lieutenant. And I'm saying, well, I hate to think of people in jeopardy. He says, well, it's best not to. And rides out. So that's the scene. So I'm standing next to him, and they're setting it up, and we got 50 cavalry behind us, and Robert Aldrich is in the trail, and he says, all right, be on your marks here. And so he's saying, son, where are you from? You NYU. You're going to NYU. And I say, yes, they had a branch down in Hell's Kitchen when I was there. We had another branch of that. It's a wonderful country. He starts moving his horse back. In a two-shot, you move your horse back. The guy behind is going to be the one that you got to turn around and look at.
Right.
In a two-shot, who are you going to look at?
Oh, Bert.
No, Bert. So, and intuitively, I knew this because of stage and upstaging. You know, it's like you do it on stage.
You're probably shocked, right?
Yes, and I am. So you're saying, so where do you live? I have a place on 72nd. Oh, that tall building there, you know, in the corner, 76 and 72. Yeah, Shelley Winters has an apartment there. Hell of a broad. Knocked her up in the 50s, you know. She's a beautiful girl. Moving his horse back. So he says, look at this beautiful country out here. And while he's looking over here, I start to move my horse back behind him. And he looks over and he goes like this. This is the most beautiful country I've ever seen, I think, sometimes, son. And I think the young lieutenant is not as innocent as he seems, are you, you little son of a bitch? At which point Aldrich says, what the hell are you two doing off your marks? Move your marks up. Get up there on the marks. We're losing the sun. So that was our first scene together. We became very good friends during the course of that. You know, it's hard to maintain friendships because we're like war buddies. You shoot them, but you can pick up 10 years later, mid-sentence. And I just loved him and adored him, and he gave me the best acting advice up until that time. Well, that's another story.
Please, I love Burt Lancaster.
Well, this is the one I tell all my students all the time, but he said, it's the end of shooting, and he says, come over here, sit by my rock, son. He says, you're a hell of an actor, goes without saying. I feel I would be remiss if I didn't give you some advice. You don't use rehearsal time properly. You're a wonderful actor, but you try to give a performance for the sound man laying the marks. You give a performance for certainly all the girl extras around here. You give a performance for everybody else, and you come to your close-up, you've shot your wad. It's like making love to a woman, or whoever you may make love to, I don't know. You can't try to come all at once. You have to have foreplay. You have to have a bit of a thigh here, a bit of a breast here. You take your time, you build it up, and then you have a performance, and you work with what you got. I got the baby blues, the pearly whites. I work with them. You got that marvelous head of hair. Save it for the close-up.
Oh, my God. Okay, I've never applauded on the show. That is the greatest
story.
You know, it makes so much sense when you talk about Burt Lancaster.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I really appreciate about him is he does all of his own stunts,
yes.
Number one.
Well, he was a trapeze artist.
Yeah, so he has complete physicality, but you really... you know, you get the feeling like when he's doing things, when he's making things, you know, when he's the Birdman of Alcatraz.
Yeah.
There is he really knows what he's doing.
By then. But if you watch the early films, you know, Pirate, I'm acting. And this is what I was doing. I mean, I would do a scene with him, and I was thinking, Jesus, I'm acting him off the screen. He's not doing nothing. And then I see the rushes, and it was like this little chihuahua nipping at the heels of a bulldog. It was just sort of, all right, son, just what?
Yeah.
Yeah, don't waste all your energy, kid. Save it for the close-up.
You know? Well, I think when you start out, everything is just about getting the emotion. You know, I'm just excited. I was just like, will I be able to cry or will I ever be?
Exactly. And this is the lesson he was teaching me coming from what he learned.
Yes.
And I've had a lot of those. You know, I've had some great people teaching me things like that. It usually boils down to the same thing. And the other great lesson I had was from, well, I'll get ahead of myself, Fonda.
Oh, my God. Now, please, go right into it.
Doing a play with him.
Mm-hmm. And what was the play?
It was Cane Mutiny, the Cane Mutiny, which he had done on Broadway and played Barney Greenwald. We were doing out here at the Amundsen. And he's a great artist, you know, kind of terrific Andrew Wyeth kind of sketches and paintings and stuff that Fonda did. He was terrific, and he knew that I was an art major, and I had studied art, and he asked to see some of my stuff, so I brought it in, and he said, this is terrific. Why did you stop? And I said, well, I was never happy with my results. They were never good enough. Mm-hmm. He says, well, that's what's wrong with your acting. You try to have a performance, and you try to have a result, and you miss the journey. It's about the journey. He says, I can draw on a picture for months, and it doesn't matter if I ever finish it. The important thing is that I enjoy doing it, and I enjoy the doing of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that was great.
So now I want to go to some of the studio. This is like, so this becomes then the second part of your career, it seems to me. You've got this before Longtime Companion. There's a bunch of, Mother Jugs and Speed, MAME, studio film. So where are you now? Are you living in New York or living in Los Angeles?
When?
At this time.
I'm going back and forth.
Like in the 70s.
In the 70s, I was a real...
Did you go back to theater? Like
I did. It was interesting because I always thought of myself as Pinocchio on Pleasure Island when I got to Hollywood. But my little neighbor, Steven Spielberg, told me that he was Pinocchio and I was Lampwick. So he told me...
And whatever happened to him anyway?
Yeah, what does he know?
But anyway, I got really tied up in the hedonism of a lot of
when
Hollywood.
When you say hedonism, does that mean drugs or
drugs, sex, or? Rock and roll? You know?
Yeah.
So that was all.
God,
you know.
That sounds so much
fun. Oh, I know.
Every time somebody says,
"Well, that was great." 69. It was. You know, I moved into Laurel Canyon.
My
I
God.
Mean, we
were you at the Daisy?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I was at the Daisy with Dino, young Dino, and Desi. And I got up to go to the bathroom, and this older gentleman pulled back his chair and says, "You kids need anything? Can I get you anything?" And I said, "No, Mr. Sinatra, we're doing fine here."
Oh,
and I
God.
Said, "Desi, I said, where's your mom?" He said, "Yeah, she's in the back. She's losing another couple grand to Baccarat, you know." So it was an interesting. So I got swept up into a lot of that. And a kid in a candy store. So by
but
the
time. That's interesting. I mean, that's everybody's here. The Roddy McDowell,
yeah,
Natalie Wood,
right.
Mia Farrow. I mean,
yeah,
just culturally.
Exactly, yeah.
But as a young person,
you can really get devoured.
And
that happened to me.
Ed Bailey talks about that a little bit.
Yeah. So what I had to do finally, when times changed again, suddenly the bright blonde boy isn't as powerful as the new young dark haired De Niro kind of person comes along with your gear. I had to go back to New York and learn how to act and sort of reinvent myself as a character actor.
Yeah.
And Robert Aldrich gave me the best advice of anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Kid, you're a hell of an actor, but don't become a leading man, because if you be a leading man, you'll do 6 pictures and you'll be washed up at 30. You'll be Skip Holmeyer, you'll be Keith Andes. Remember them? Cover Life Magazine." He said, "That'll happen to you. You gotta be a character actor. Do the supporting roles. Do the villains and the victims and the doctors and the lawyers and the Indian chiefs, and you can raise a family in this town." And I said, "Fuck you." And it's what happened to me.
Yeah.
It's what came about and what happened. I went back to New York. I did The Elephant Man, did a lot of theater, would come out, and I took supporting roles. And I've been a character actor sort of ever since, you know.
One movie just from this period that, again, my mother would take. We'd go to the movies. I was mainly traumatized by films that she'd take me to, but one of them was Short Eyes, which is horrifying.
Yeah,
Really, really.
Yeah, well, that's what I did. That was one of the films I did when I went back to New York.
And that started as a play.
Yes, it was a play.
And how did you get involved? Were you involved in the play at all?
I saw the play. I just fell in love with it. I went back to New York and tried to get involved in it. And I was given the part of of Clark Davis, which I guess I was kind of a name at that time. And no name would really touch that part. It's a child molester thrown into the prison that's gang raped and have his throat cut, and you know, it's
my mother took me to this movie.
Oh, I can imagine. Yes,
we used to just go to the movie, and you would be sitting there going, "I don't know if this is appropriate," but anyway.
And they were all, and it was a real film done by Miguel Pinheiro, and they had written it in Sing Sing in Ossining, and Joe Papitt put it on off Broadway, and it was outrageous because it was the grandfather of Oz and all those prison movies that came afterward. But it was as realistic as you could imagine at the time, based on a real incident of, you know, this guy being tortured by prisoners who's thrown in, and the guards say, "Take care of him." And it was. It was pretty scary because all the guys that did it had originally done the play, and they were all out of Sing Sing, and you know, these guys were murderers and rapists and killers and everything. Even the guards had been prisoners, and the one guy was saying, "I hope we get this scene before lunch. I'm getting horny," and I'm thinking, "Oh my God, can I pull my pants up at least here?"
God,
it was scary to make. It was a scary film to make, but a great film.
Were you proud of your work in it, or could you see that at the time, or was it just so traumatic?
I can never see what's going to be successful, because you're probably one of the 5 people that saw it originally. I mean, nobody went to see it. It was a film that became buried. And people realize later what you've done, but, you know.
I remember it being very well reviewed. Well, yeah, I would always read.
It was. It was, you know, one of the top 12 films of the year, but people didn't see it.
Really?
No.
I think Roger
Ebert. It's not a great date movie.
No. But anyway, a very powerful movie to see.
Yeah.
And, okay, so let's get to Longtime Companion and how that came about. You work with Mark Lamos.
Yes.
He was the artistic. When I was a child working at the Hartford Stage Company Youth Theater, he was the artistic director and really changed the trajectory of the Hartford Stage Company at the time. So
Mark was wonderful.
Yeah.
And I've got a story about this as well,
sure,
which is quite telling. But my ex-wife, wife at the time, had worked with Norman Rene and Craig Lucas. Mm-hmm. And I got to meet them, and I auditioned for them in New York for the play, and for the film. And the film was originally a Playhouse, a PBS Playhouse film that maybe, if they were lucky, they were going to get on TV. Mm-hmm. They were going to get on public TV if they weren't taken away, because it was about AIDS, and it was, you know. By the time the film was released, my manager, my agent, and my first commercial agent all died. Was the whole middle of the Holocaust when that film was made. But I remember we were shooting, I was telling the story before, we were shooting up in on Riverside Drive in an apartment, and I was shooting the scene where I'm telling my lover to let go and all, and the woman found out that we were not shooting a murder mystery and threw us out, and we tried to get more money to pay her off so we could shoot the film. This is 3 a.m, so they say, all right, everybody take a break. I look down on the street down below there, and there are 400 extras dressed in 40s attire. They have 3 trucks that have snowed in the middle of the summer, all of Riverside Drive, and down sitting there on 2 chairs where Ron Silver and Paul Mazursky and I walk down while they're trying to negotiate how to finish this scene. And I said, God, if I could just have an opportunity once to make a big film and make, you know, and have a kind of backing, not have to worry about everything all the time. This is, you know, just get an opportunity to do something like this would be the greatest thing to happen to me. A year later, I'm nominated for Longtime Companion. I'm sitting in the third row at the awards ceremony. And behind me is Ron Silver, who's nominated for another film. He comes and he taps me on the shoulder and he says, film was called Enemies. It lasted a weekend. Aww. Be careful what you wish for.
That's amazing. That's so true. Yeah. Well, you seem to be so appreciative of the journey that you were on. I mean,
I'm old. I get to look back and say that now. I can say to kids, you know, use rehearsal time properly.
Yeah.
Save it for the close-up. I get to be that guy now.
And the movie's so interesting. At the Golden Globes, you beat out folks like Al Pacino, Joe Pesci from Goodfellas.
Who beat me in the Academy Awards, which you were in the middle of at the time. Which was, which was his seminal performance of his.
But does it seem, in doing my research and looking at the movie, does it feel like it does to me that there's a lack of films like this now, that we need to go back to these smaller stories?
That would be great if there were some sort of way to have an independent channel that actually made independent films that wasn't series. Or something.
Yeah.
They started to do that on Showtime, and then they got into. They had 26 at 1 year. I got to direct one with Hugh Cronin, and Adam Mark and Sherilyn Finn and Rory Culkin. But at the time, I said, "Well, how about next year? What's going to happen next year?" He says, "There's not going to be any next year. It's all going to be series," and that's sort of where we are now. We have to evolve into a place where there's a safe place where independent films can fail or succeed on a channel, and it's not based on numbers and, you know, what's going to be successful. Maybe this is, maybe not. I remember seeing Richard Boone's Theater, which was a TV series in the early 60s. It was called the Richard Boone Theater, and he had great actors, Bobby Blake and Bethel Leslie and all kinds of terrific actors in a rep company. And every week somebody, you know, Rod Serling or something would write a half-hour movie for them.
Oh, Rod Serling.
And it was the greatest thing I remembered as a kid, but they don't exist now. They're, everything's based on the dollar. It's got to succeed. Sorry.
So yeah. Let's get to that
We've
great...
We talked about it before here.
Yeah.
We don't have too much time left, so I want to spend time with talking about Grace of My Heart.
Yes.
And in the film that we were in with the wonderful Allison Anders.
Wonderful.
And how did you... How did that come about? How did you meet Allison?
I guess I just auditioned for Allison, or she called. Mm-hmm. I can't remember that. What I remember more than anything else is the love scene we had in the zoo.
Well, thank you.
Well, I do, but I failed you in that scene.
I know, yes. You say this.
No, I do, because
interesting.
I thought about it driving home. I was playing a character who's guilt-riven.
He's a married man, and he's
Catholic, and he's everything else. But he's passionately involved with this other woman, and he just finally leaves her in my short section of the thing. But I remember sitting on a stump or something, and you were trying to get me to be more passionate, and I was playing a character who was so guilt-ridden that, you know, I got to be sucked into this, real coy, and it was the wrong choice for me to make in that. And I should have listened to you, and I thought of that in the drive home. I should have gone for the bone.
Right.
In that scene.
Was it just to me, because an affair is passionate.
Yes, it is.
You know, and also I remember in terms of the men in the film, I had just come off of the relationship with Eric Stoltz.
Yeah.
So we were the young lovers.
Right.
And then he cheats on me.
Right. And you had some heavy hitters coming up down the road, and I wanted to be different from that.
Right.
But it was the wrong choice.
So interesting. Well, we have to go back and
You can never go back. I mean, you always think of this shit on the 405.
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I always do. There's always a film where I'll go back and why didn't I do that? Why don't I just do one more take and try that? Well, and that happens to me in everything I've ever done.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, sometimes back in the day, it only happened to me a couple times, but there were times in certain films that I said, please give me another chance.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was lucky. And nowadays, it'd be like, no.
Right. I'm sorry. That's lunch.
We've got lunch.
We got it both ways. That's what they say to you.
Yeah.
We got it both ways. It's all right. No, it's fine. We got it both ways. Yeah. Right.
But the movie Grace of My Heart has really held up for people. And
it's a wonderful movie. And, you know, it's... You know, you're the heart and soul of it. You and Allison. You are Allison. It's a very close story to both of you.
Yes.
And,
We were playing her, at times playing me.
It was a great symbiosis of a film, and that's why it holds up as a classic.
We were trying to make a kind of a 70s movie. Mm-hmm. Very briefly, we were both... I have to mention Seinfeld, just because you pop up on rotation.
I do on
the channel. Did you have fun doing that?
I had the greatest time of my life because I ended up marrying Michael Richards' girlfriend, but after they had split up for about 3 years.
I didn't know that.
Yes,
Mr. Michael Richards.
Rochelle and Ed Begley introduced me to my wife.
Wow. But did you have any, I was scared when I did the show.
I'm always scared.
I was more scared of doing that.
Anytime I do a sitcom, I'm petrified because there is such pressure. Everybody is saying, well, should we fire them and get somebody else? We got an hour and a half. We could do that. And I did a sitcom for 3 years and I saw it from the other angle. You know, these poor kids and girls and stuff would come in and they had no time to prepare, no time to do anything. And then suddenly you're thrust in there and you've got a whole corporate structure standing behind you saying, get rid of that girl.
Right.
You know, or get rid of that. And it's the worst.
Did you try? My worst thing was just trying to be funny because they're so funny. And I kept having to just walk away
and let myself hit the head and go,
don't try to be fun. Do not try to be funny.
Oh, that's the key, I think, to that show. Just don't do anything. Just say the words and find the lights, which was the other great advice I was given by Hume Cronin, who told me to do that when I was doing Glass Menagerie. He says, you know, say the words, find your light, don't try to act it.
Yeah. And so some of the current movies that you've been in, some of these huge, big-budget movies, what does that feel like to be in, like, X-Men or...
Cog in a wheel, and lucky to get a great paycheck,
right?
and to be part of you know, whatever that is. It's not, you know, all my greatest acting in X-Men is done on the CGI screen as I melt all over Halle Berry. I wasn't even there for most of it.
Do they bring you in for Comic-Con and all those kind of things?
I do that sometimes, yeah. But, you know, I'm kind of, I did a show called Who Is That Guy and That Thing? I'm kind of that guy. Everybody thinks they know you, but they
really?
Don't quite know your name and know what your life. And I'll be sitting next to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and she'll sell 27,000 wooden stakes.
Yeah.
And I'll have five guys saying, don't I know you from somewhere? See, so it's weird. You know,
your career as being, you know, that you're going to have the third act is going to be, you know, that there's so
Gabby
many.
Gabby Hayes.
Yeah. Exactly. No.
I don't think Roy's going to like that.
No, that's the, you know, like my grandfather had a secondary career.
Right.
He was
playing my grandfather.
Yeah. And we're going to have Randall Kleiser on to talk about. But my grandfather was working, you know, in his 80s.
Well, he was always a great character actor.
Yeah.
I mean, he got out a leading man, and he was a perfect example of that.
Did theater.
He was always that guy, getting Academy Awards, you know, right up to the very end of his life.
So I always joke sometimes at a movie, I go, oh, that's the Melvin Douglas part.
Yes.
Like, you know, the old senator.
Well, I'd be honored to have that part. They're always the great parts, too, because what do you got to lose?
You
got to
knock out that Alan Alda. He's just got to push him out of the way.
He's still there. Well, he's a few years ahead of me. Wonderful. You know, he'll go.
I love Alan Alda.
Yeah, I do, too.
But I see you. You know, do you want to work up until?
Oh, yeah. I'm just, you know, I'm working next month. I'm going off.
I'm leaving here. I got a gig.
I'm leaving here. I got a gig. I got a loop. I got to do voiceover.
Working all the time. Well, Bruce, it's been such an honor to have you here. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, my
Please
darling.
Come back anytime.
Yes.
Okay.
You've
tomorrow?
Got such great stories. Yeah.
Okay.
In an hour.
I'll
tomorrow
be here.
Will be good.
Come back. I'll be here.
You all can right. find Bruce on Twitter at Bruce_Davison and on Instagram at Bruce.Davison.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know any of that stuff.
Well, that's okay.
Just
we
Google
do, and now
Davison.
Everybody else will know. Thank you, Bruce. Also, you can buy Ileana's book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, on Amazon.
Yes, you
it's
can.
Now out in paperback.
Yes,
also, like our Facebook page, and
please.
Our website is ilianaspodcast.com.
That's right. Thanks, everyone, for all the great comments. They're really inspiring. Bruce Davison, thank you for being here today.
Thank you. And your book is wonderful, too.
Oh, well,
just,
thank you.
Know, reading, catching up on that.
I appreciate that. You know, James Woods calls me the thinking man sex symbol.
Well,
it's my favorite review.
I know. And so you better keep a lid on Jimmy for a while. I'll try to do that.
I have no fingerprints on me. I'm just a friend. I'm a friend of the family, as my
just
grandfather
gotta,
says in Mr. Blandings.
Bill
Lawrence, friend of the family. Everyone's life is like a movie with a beginning and a middle and an end, and this
right.
is the end of ours. So, roll credits, everyone. Have a great day.
Thanks,
Bruce.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network. The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.